This is Conversations on Living, a podcast about being well, doing well, and living well. My name's Chris Brock, and this week we're doing something a little bit different than we normally do. We're replaying a conversation from July 2020. And this is a conversation I had with Martha Beck. Now, back then, the world had just gone into lockdown for the first time, and I was normally doing these podcasts face to face. But in a way, the COVID pandemic actually gave me a great opportunity to explore what could be done with the technology, and I started reaching out to people to have conversations remotely over Zoom, and I got lucky with Martha Beck. Martha Beck is an incredibly insightful writer. Her own story is fantastic. She grew up in the Mormon church, and she started going through a kind of pretty brutal process of rejecting the doctrines of life that had been given to her by the church, by her family, by what was expected from society. In essence, she broke from the culture. And in her teachings, she teaches us how we all have to break from the culture, from our own personal culture, from the culture of our peer groups, from society, in order to find out who we really are and do what the things we came here to do. I've just finished her latest book, The Way of Integrity, which was obviously a best-selling book and has been featured on Oprah's book club. Oprah and Martha Beck are good friends, and this was a really bit of a landmark conversation for me, and it changed a lot of my thinking, and her writing has been very important for me. So if you're looking for the thing, the alignment with yourself that you're seeking out, I would thoroughly recommend Martha Beck's work, and I am going to replay this conversation that we had today, this week. Normally, I keep a few conversations in the bag as backup, but everyone here has had COVID, so we used up that backlog, and then we had a cancellation this week, so it's given me a brilliant opportunity to share one of my favourite conversations again. So check out this conversation with me and Martha Beck. I was very lucky that she was able to spare some time. She was under lockdown too, and so she was most gracious and generous with her wisdom and her insight. And you can find out more about her at www.marthabeck.com. So I implore, just listen to this, read her books, and maybe that you can find out who you came here to be. All right, thanks a lot. Enjoy this conversation, and I will see you afterwards. So Martha Beck, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. You are the author of several books, but this is the one I'm in the process of working my way through at the moment, Finding Your Way in a Wild New World. And it claims to say that you're the best known life coach in America.
Well, according to the reporter who said that, I think I'm very well known among people who've heard of me.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too, actually. But it's funny because when I started reading your work, the reason I reached out to you in the first place is because I am hungry for things to read that inspire me. And I buy a lot of books and I pick up a lot of books, and then I end up putting a lot of them down after just a few chapters. But some of your writing really resonated with me and my own kind of ideas about consciousness and where we are in the world and finding our own way. And you talk a lot about finding your own true north and things like that. And in this book, you kind of introduced, well, and in your coaching practice as well, you talk about the notion of wayfinders. So can you just, maybe that's a good place to start, introduce wayfinding and what that means?
Sure. Well, the research I did for the book you're talking about now is I went to pre-modern people, traditional people, tribal people, whatever you want to call them. And I was interested in the wisdom that had been passed down from generations, from millennia. And one of those groups in Polynesia is called the Wayfinders. And well, they're called in English, the Wayfinders. I didn't want to appropriate any tribal name, but it seemed self-explanatory. And these people, all the people really that I was talking to, they seemed superhuman. And in the case of the Polynesian wayfinders, these were people who navigated to the Hawaiian Islands from like New Guinea because they could extrapolate the existence of these islands 3,000 miles away by the way the water broke on the hulls of their canoes. They were like supercomputers. And the human brain is capable of this incredible ability to find its way. And then I found in many other traditional peoples, like the Australian original people, in Africa, I talked to people from a few tribes, and they had these ways of finding paths through the land that were lands that were uncharted. So I thought, if we need anything right now, it's someone who knows the way through an unfamiliar landscape. And the Polynesian wayfinders in particular appealed to me because the environment we're in now, I mean, right now we're under lockdown. Nobody knew we'd be here a year ago. It's shifting so rapidly. It's not even like trying to find a path over land. It's like trying to find a path through rough water. Yeah. But there are people who did it. So that's what the book set out to look at, like, and use that for a metaphor about how we can live our own lives in the modern world.
And it's funny because you talk a lot about wordlessness. Mm-hmm. And I initially thought that was kind of like a kind of another way of saying flow states, but actually it's much more than that, isn't it? It's about kind of breaking free of the limitations of language that we put on ourselves. Yeah. And I remember I used to, when I would get the train to work in the morning, I used to see this piece of graffiti, and it said, beneath the threshold of consciousness, everything was seething with life. And I looked it up, and it was Carl Jung. Mm. And it's just this idea that there is another world below this kind of conscious physical reality. And yeah. I think you touch on that a little bit with the idea of worldlessness. And then is it the ever when?
The original Australians have a word that is sometimes translated the dreaming or the dream time, but it can also be translated the every when, because it's where time is compressed into a single moment. And actually, Carl Jung was someone from our culture who went looking for these other ways of viewing reality and for different states of consciousness. But we're in the tiny minority of cultures that don't have concepts for that. It's just that our tiny minority cultures took over the world. So the post-materialist European worldview is very mechanistic. It's very it's very straightforward and materialistic. Even though our physics now goes way beyond that, we stay in this sort of Newtonian world where it's just a bunch of objects bumping into each other, and that's all there is. And Jung didn't like that, and he went looking for something different, and he knew a lot of tribal people, and he had the same dreamscapes in his own mind that people were dreaming in Australia or North America or South America or Africa. So there is this, beneath the threshold of the conscious world, there is this every when, and I think we sense it, we feel it, some of us to greater degrees than others. But you know, Freud focused so heavily on sexuality because it was an aspect of natural human experience that was repressed in his culture. And I think that our natural human experience that's being repressed right now is mysticism. The ability to experience that teeming world beneath the threshold of consciousness. And I think people are, I think it's as hard to navigate your life without that as if you'd lost a limb. I think that it's really, we are working at a huge disadvantage, and we really need it back now more than ever, right?
I mean, it's hard though, because all of that kind of stuff is kind of looked upon as being a little bit weird, a little bit out there. I mean, you talked in one of your masterclasses recently about how we're born free of any of these kind of restrictions of language, of socialization, and all of these kind of things. And then we kind of get that buried on us by expectations and by this kind of this structured system that we end up having to buy into, and which is a system that feeds off our dissatisfaction. You know, it needs to keep us feeling unhappy with who we are and where we are and what we're doing, so it can sell us more stuff. And so we can earn more money and pay more taxes and that kind of thing. So how do we go about tapping back into our, I think you call it your essential self.
Essential self. I've called it different things in different books. Yeah. But it's the part of self that is watching all, for example, watching your own process of thinking. Yeah. You can watch yourself think, oh, I had an idea. Like you remember yourself reading some graffiti and having a reaction to it. And the question that they would ask in many cultures is, who is watching that? What's the part of you watching that? I think Martin Buber said, who we are looking for is who is looking. So all the mystics in every culture, including ours, go there. As you say, we've basically had it squished out of us by our culture because material advantage and success is so primary in the culture that we happen to live in. And that single value is what led to the domination of the world and now the destruction of many ecosystems. And our definition of winning is who kills the most people and ends up with the most stuff.
Yeah.
And a lot of the cultures that were destroyed had a different definition of success. It was, what is your quality of life and how many people can thrive in your system? So I talked to a South American shaman while I was writing that book, and he said, they say, teach me to fish, I eat for a day. Give me a fish, I eat for a day. Teach me to fish, I eat for a lifetime. And he said, in my culture, we say, I will teach you to make sure that there are always plenty of fish and you will eat forever. And we are so proud of our kill and grab philosophy that we're constantly saying, we won, we won, we won. And now we have, we're looking at a global failure of this system of wealth, because it doesn't stand up to things like, what are people's physical capacities? What are the needs of the human body and spirit? What are the needs of the ecosystems that we live in? You know, we're interrupting ecosystems where wild animals have viruses that are jumping to us because we're not supposed to be interacting with them in a typical ecosystem, and the world seems to be trying to find its balance again. And our culture is so bizarrely exaggerated and strange. I don't know if you've heard the acronym weird cultures, Western educated, industrialized, rich and developed. The strangest philosophy of life that has ever come out of our species, but because it's so dominant in terms of wealth and power, we think it's normal.
Yeah.
It's not normal. And so how do we find our way when every inch of culture is tearing us off our natural bearings? I was trained as a sociologist, and while I was doing my dissertation research, I realized that all society is based on a single dynamic that has happened over and over. And that is that a single human being goes away from the group and has an experience that says, I think I know how I want to live my life, and it has nothing to do with what anyone else thinks. They come back to the group and they live according to this way of being, which is not about other people. In Greek, that it's called charisma. And Max Weber took it out of obscurity and used it to say, this is the single quality around which other people cohere to create a society. So that's what I keep trying to get people to do in every book I write. Go and have that situation, that relationship, that experience that is without social context. Find your, you know, still point, your North Star, whatever it is, come back and do not let it go, no matter what they say.
Yeah.
And I honestly think that's the only way to save ourselves or our species right now.
Because it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you talk about this kind of weird culture, and I often think about it like processed foods. You know, when you eat, and you talk about eating kind of natural foods in your book, but when you're eating healthily, sort of very kind of raw and unprocessed foods and salads and eating off the land, you're very healthy. But the more processed your food becomes, the more susceptible you are to illnesses and disease and heart disease and things like that. Yeah. And I think it's the same for the spirit. The moment we start to move away from our kind of natural state of being and moving to these kind of processed formats of living in society, we start to struggle with anxiety and depression, and we lose our way. We don't know who we are anymore or what we're here for and that kind of thing.
That's a really good point. And you know, when Thoreau wrote "The Majority of Men Lead Lives of Quiet Desperation," he wasn't talking about humankind in general. He was specifically referring to men who had been taken out of their homes to work in factories.
Yeah.
And so it was after the Industrial Revolution, which is a heartbeat ago historically, right? And it took, I often think about this when I'm coaching men, because the way I see sort of the men in the tribes that I went to and observed, they were outside, they were doing physical work, they were tracking animals, they were using tremendous amounts of logic and inspiration and science, each in their own cultural context. And then I come back to my own culture and I see men put in, and women, but men even more, put in these little boxes where there's no fresh air, and there are only these little tasks to do that are about feeding the great machine of the industrialized world. And that's only been since the mid 19th century. And that's when Thoreau said, we lost ourselves. And I think it's really true, particularly for you guys.
Well, I think we're being fed a very strange diet of responsibility, media, and all these kind of things that actually keep us distracted from our kind of spiritual essence. And I don't necessarily mean spirit as in like our sense of who we are, rather than our kind of, you know, this notion of crystals and justice, yeah, and things like that. But this notion of the everywhen.
Yeah.
You talk about it. I wrote a book a few years ago, and I talk about these kind of ethereal threads that connect us to everything and everyone in the universe, going back in time infinitely, even to, sure, ideas and imagination. Do you think that everyone is an actual shared space where we can tap into ideas, or do you think is it a metaphor? How do you use it?
I used to think it was a metaphor, and then I began to have so many experiences that I ended up with no logical conclusion except to believe that it was real. And because when I would go do research with different cultural groups, I use something called participant observation, which is, you know, it's one of the only ways you can do research on a different culture without putting the bias of your own culture on top of it. So I would do things. I would go into an ayahuasca ceremony, and I didn't take the ayahuasca, but in the middle, I think it's later in the book, in the middle of this ayahuasca ceremony, my whole body started shaking, and it was absolutely apparent to me that I was being shaken by trees. There were trees that were shaking my body, and there are people all around me throwing up and having epiphanies or whatever, but I was on nothing. And the trees were giving me this tremendous sensation of love and inclusion and information that later turned out to be true. And I had many experiences like that. I think you actually have to try really hard not to have such experiences. But if you do have them, you're considered a lunatic in our culture.
Yeah.
So we very carefully, you know, circumscribe our own experience, even from what we long for. We keep ourselves away from it because we would be cultural outcasts if we acknowledged it, if we felt it. And most recently, I have just finished writing a book called The Way of Integrity, which is based on Dante's Divine Comedy, loosely. And a lot of people don't understand, especially the last book of the Divine Comedy, the Paradiso, because it gets so weird. But if you compare it with enlightenment experiences from Asia or from the North American Indians, the Siberian shamans, he's right in line with that. So, and we now know that there is a neurostructural change in someone who has that experience. It's physically observable. Yeah. But at the end, he does something really interesting. Right before he disappears as a being, he switches from past tense to present tense. And in the last few lines, he starts speaking to us now. And I had the weirdest experience reading that over and over and writing about it and reading commentaries. Because when he steps into now, it's not 1320, it's now.
Yeah.
Like, and suddenly I felt like I was in the intersection between the plane of eternity and the plane of time. And I was dreaming these strange dreams, and Dante was right there. And it was so real. This is just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, there isn't everyone. All of history is incorporated in it. All of time is incorporated in it. And all of distance is incorporated in it. And we're capable of touching it. And hey, what else should we do? Just sit around and like punch the clock until we die? Let's have some fun.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there is a sense that we're kind of like you said, that we're scared to touch into or tap into these things, or even try to tap into them, because we will get labeled as lunatics. But reading something that you wrote reminded me of Pema Chodron. I don't know if you know the Buddhist teacher. And she said something, only to the extent that we expose ourselves over and over to annihilation can that which is indestructible in us be found. And I was wondering if we have to just surrender completely, because I've been trying to bend the spoon, like you said in your book. And
wish I had one here. I'd bend it for you and show you.
No, I did have one, but my daughter ran off with it. She's 2 years old now, so she's stolen my spoon. But
we'll bring it back tied into a bow.
Exactly. But it's this whole idea that the harder you try, the further away you get from your intrinsic self and this every when kind of connection to the infinite.
Well, we aren't taught how to find that zone of electromagnetic energies. I mean, we are wireless electromagnetic machines that have magnetic and electrical fields that project out of our bodies for at least 10 feet, measurable by instruments, and theoretically infinite. So what's interesting about something like bending a spoon, and I learned this from an anthropologist, an American anthropologist who specialized in Siberian shamanism. She didn't want to talk about Siberian shamanism. She just picked up a fork in the restaurant where we were eating and just gently folded it, this 82-year-old woman. And I was like, what? And she said, no, pick up your fork, I'll show you. So what happens is people do, even like the Harry Potter series, which I love, when they're trying to do magic, the veins on their foreheads bulge and they're screaming, Expelliarmus! And they're trying to exert the energy that one exerts in a factory to make stuff. And that is not where all the action is. The action is in the space where meditators go, in the space where animal trackers go, in the space where the song catchers go, in the cultures that go out and catch music from the atmosphere. And it's almost a dozing state. And it's right, I had my brain mapped and everything so I could see what was happening. And it's right in the center of the brain. There's a lot of crisscrossing, and two areas of the brain go very quiet. One is the area that makes us feel like we're separate from the rest of the world. And the other is the area that makes us feel like we're in control. So you lose self, total annihilation, and you lose control, total annihilation. The two things our culture tells us never to lose, you surrender over and over, take myself, take all control. And then you pick up a fork or a spoon, or once I actually fixed my car this way, you say to a piece of metal, will you play with me?
Yeah.
And sometimes it won't, and you have no say in the matter, but sometimes it says yes, and suddenly you can turn it into a corkscrew, or, you know, it's just,
yeah.
And once that's happened, you can't go back without making yourself a hypocrite and a liar. If that actually happened to you, you either have to throw away the Western materialist worldview or be a traitor to yourself. And that's why I started writing about integrity. Because, yeah, if you're going to be in truth and you're going into experiences like that, the culture definitely will throw you away.
Do you think it's that same kind of connection? You talk about the Polynesian sailors at the beginning, and they have this kind of connection to the sea, and to the, they know how the waves kind of move over the ocean, and they can find their way for thousands of miles without any navigation aids. Do you think it's that same kind of sense of, when athletes get into a flow state,
definitely
they perform their at their very best. But when they start to intellectualize it and take themselves out of that, then they
or even effort, the whole concept of effort, and it's not. It's really interesting to me because those people weren't just mystically, because what you said about the crystals and the New Age stuff, there's that extreme as well. And a lot of people read my work and they think, oh, it's all about, you know, I'm just going to bring in a magical hummingbird to give me a message that will take me to heaven and bring me money. And I'm just like, no, that's not it either. You're swinging very wide into a kind of simplistic magical thinking. And in fact, what those people were doing was they were using so many aspects of their brain. Oh my gosh. When I go out tracking in South Africa with my friends there, these people are supercomputers. They are stone cold geniuses. These people would, I spent 10 years at Harvard. These people would mop the floor with most of the people I met at Harvard. They are so bright and they are working on all cylinders, and they're paying attention to the stars and the land and the sea and the sounds and the smells and this ineffable every when. That when push comes to shove on a cloudy night in a storm where they fell asleep for 5 minutes and the supercomputer went down, they can get it back by connecting with this thing. And it's a brain state, it's observable, it's real, we don't believe in it. And if we don't start accepting it, our whole culture is going down right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's happening.
I mean, do you think that, on a kind of going off on a tangent, do you think there is a chance that we can, you know, bring it back, get that back, and sort of
it's
the change in society?
The book you're reading now, I grew up desperate to try to like save the ecosystems and fix, you know, very fascinated with animals and with the wild and desperate to save everything. And then I gave up. Now I got to middle age and I was like, it's over, man. The scientists are saying, and they are now saying, if we did everything possible, say to reverse climate change, it means we would go off the edge of the cliff at 20 miles an hour instead of 70 miles an hour. But we can't back up.
Yeah.
So I thought, all right, well then, let me just get out while the getting's good. And I was in Africa tracking, and I tracked up on a rhinoceros and thought I was going to die. It's quite interesting to be on foot, unarmed, with an angry rhinoceros looking at you. And I had this overwhelming sense of letting go. And I think I let go of those two things, the sense of self and the sense of control. And I thought, this is how I'm going to die. And there was such a joyful release of, I never have to worry anymore. And I let everything go. And it went, it was like my whole vision of the future disappeared into blackness. And then everything lit up again, shoom, with a very different future. And in this future, we saved the world. And I don't know if that, I mean, it could be complete mania. I don't really care, frankly. But I love the idea that it's a possible future.
Yeah.
In this version of the multiverse reality, you know, so all my cards are on the table. I'm laying all my bets to say, yeah, I think we can do it, but oh my God, it's close to the wire.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the next few years, completely unpredictable. We have to be wayfinders to find our way through this next period where I have no clue what will be in the paper in the morning. None of us do.
You know? Well, I mean, it's changing so fast. It's like it feels like fiction. It feels so unreal anyway that you kind of think, well, you know, the whole notion of what we consider to be real, the physical world that we live in, is just becoming so bizarre anyway that we might as well explore these other realities and these other ways of being and other ways of thinking.
I want to just, and I do mean to let you get a word in edgewise, right. But I have to tell you, the book I was working on 2 years ago was a book about a worldwide plague with its epicenter in Manhattan. And it was the reason everything had to stop. And I was working on a fantasy novel about a worldwide pandemic epicentered in New York City with a real troll in the White House. And then it happened. I've got no more book to write. But where did I pull that plot? Like, where did that come from? Yeah. I don't know. I don't write novels. I mean, I've written one, but not that. And I sat there with charts and grids figuring out how it affect all the different social systems. And here it is.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I wonder if all of these signs are here for us anyway. I mean, you talk about your spirit mule, or you've mentioned the spirit mule a few times, and I kept that with me, you know, paying attention to what, or noticing what you notice. Yeah. And I was on the train again. I was writing one of my blog posts, and it was a blog post about fear. And I was a little bit stuck, and I looked out of the window, and in neon lights, I saw the word courage.
Wow.
And courage is a brewery, so they make beer in England. But at that moment, when I needed a bit of inspiration, I saw the word courage. And I thought, well, that's my spirit mule right there, sort of my intuition popping up into...
And the more the number of things that have happened to me now that are just beyond coincidence, I was writing about... in the book that I'm writing now, I wanted to put in a story about how these strange coincidences and these magical things happened to me at this one game preserve where I run seminars called Londolozi in South Africa. And I was getting ready to write about some of the mystical things, the strange things. And suddenly I just thought, no, I don't want to write right now. I want to actually go read the work of someone I hadn't read for a long time, a humor columnist in the US. And I thought, I'm going to go see if he's written anything. He had literally that month put out a book for the first time in 10 years. I downloaded it on Kindle. I read the first three chapters. The third chapter is about how this author went to Londolozi and met an elephant whom I know personally. So I was about to write this. I put down my writing. I get a book that I've never heard of, and it's about the thing I'm just getting ready to write. And then stuff like that happens to me every single day. And I have to downscale so that people will believe me. But the more you go into it, the more it happens.
I mean, do you think we're just constantly being bombarded with messages, if you like, both from our subconscious and also from, you know, the other domains, other you know, parts of the multiverse, if you want. And it's just up to us to open ourselves up to receiving them and to pick up on it.
Definitely. I mean, so many people went before us, so many brilliant people in different parts of the world, and they were all saying things like, you know, my undergraduate major was in Chinese. So the Chinese philosophy is all, you know, in the pursuit of knowledge, you every day you add something. In the pursuit of awakening, every day you drop something, you know, until your mind is clear and open. And then what comes in will be often magical looking. Pay no attention to it. That's not the point. You'll go through that, and then you'll get to a place where you're completely at peace. And when you're completely at peace, you will know how to run your life. You will know how to run the world. And nobody's doing it. But all of these brilliant cultures were not, they weren't stupid. They weren't backward. They weren't childlike just because they came before. In many ways, they were the adults, and we are the, sorry, fellow Americans, but we in the USA in particular are like the whining adolescents who don't know what's what yet and don't respect the older generations for the wisdom they have. Yeah, I think when we reach peace, when you let go of the striving that our culture is so obsessed with and you come into a place of peace, everything comes to find you. And it's everything that we tell children stories about because it delights them. And then we say, we can't be delighted anymore. We're grown up. No, it can get more and more and more delightful. It's supposed to.
I mean, I guess in order to embrace that, though, we have to open ourselves up to, you know, annihilation like Pema Chodron.
Social suicide.
And I mean, you mentioned Lao Tzu and the Tao Te Ching. And, you know, those or that which knows doesn't speak, and that which speaks doesn't know, you know. And we have to find our peace and let go of everything.
I mean, we're the most left hemisphere dominated culture in history. That we let go of more of our reality than anyone. We're running on half a tank and thinking we're the smartest people that ever lived, and it's just arrogant, frankly.
So how do we then balance? Because I'm, as you describe, I'm someone who is a kind of a realist who believes in miracles. So I believe that scientists are, you know, they're the magicians who found out how the trick works in a way.
Yeah.
And, you know, 100 years ago, some of the things or many of the things they were doing, they would be burned at the stake for witchcraft, you know.
Absolutely.
So how do we balance where we need to be in the practical world with accessing that kind of intrinsic knowledge of ourselves so that we can find our peace? How do we show up in both domains at once without there being a kind of clash?
It's tricky. It's interesting. Some of the people that I have met, as I said, what is known in Asia as enlightenment or awakening is actually associated with different brain traits, which if they're rehearsed over and over become different brain structures. People who live in that space have something called a primal world belief that is different from most people in our culture. A primal world belief, this just came out of a huge study using Twitter. So they actually were able to look at millions of cases. So the statistics are really solid. Most of us live in a world that is dead, inert, meaningless. At least we perceive it that way. And it's a primal world belief. And so it filters everything we see. And that's what comes into us. But there are some people, and those who've been through enlightenment experiences are very much in this camp, that see the world as, the acronym they gave was safe, enticing, and alive.
Okay.
Everything is safe, enticing, and alive. And if you go out in the world with that perspective, people respond to you in really interesting ways. Generally, they're much happier to see you. They respond with more kindness, with more relaxation. They've shown that your brain state can entrain another brain into, and the calmer brain will pull the other brain into its state of calm. So everyone will love to be around you. But if you start talking as if the world is safe, enticing, and alive, you'll get pilloried. You know, people will say you have magical thinking problems, you're insane. And it's funny, I was striking a pretty good balance before the lockdown happened. Yeah. Then I was in lockdown for a while. I forgot how people think and talk. And so I think I put too much of the magic into the book I just wrote. And I had to like backpedal because my editors didn't understand what I meant. They thought people were just getting over a physical illness when they had an enlightenment experience. And there was no other framework for it. And I had to dial it way back. So you go out into the world. One woman I met in Asia said they love it when you're, they hate it when you're a Buddhist, but they love it when you're a Buddha.
Yeah.
So go out into the world awake, looking at the safe, enticing, alive, the sea of being, but keep it to yourself. Be careful how you talk and listen a lot. Yeah. And people will gravitate to that. And that is the charisma of which Max Weber wrote.
And you talk about paradoxes as well. Sometimes just kind of being the thing you want to receive in a way, you know, if you want to be interesting, be interested in other people and, you know, give that energy out and it will attract people to you. But it's really interesting. There's something Henri Matisse said, which is the essential thing is to work in a state of mind that approaches prayer.
Oh,
which is a really nice quote, which seemed to resonate a little bit. The only reason I've only got halfway through your book is because every two or three lines I end up having to write something down and desperately think of something else. But do you think you've done yourself a disservice by reining it in a bit in your next book, but you know, rather than letting yourself?
Question. I mean, we're on a razor's edge right now. It's really interesting. It's so easy to push people into the zone where they're defensive and the culture slams shut so many hopeful states of mind because we have had the hope slammed out of us because it was to the profit of people who were above us in the social hierarchy. So if a little bit of hope dawns, we've had it slammed out of us, and everyone has experienced that. Some of the shamans that I spoke to said this was the central trauma of our culture, that we've had the hopes and the dreams smashed out of us in favor of being materially focused and producing wealth. And they said, if we don't heal that trauma, there's a kind of PTSD that occurs where if you see someone else walk into hope, you slam them.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of that. It's funny. I've had it from both super religious or even new age people who don't like my focus on science. And then I've had it from scientists who just discount any evidence that doesn't fit their materialist worldview. So you have to have a pretty tough skin. You have to be willing to be annihilated, as Pema Chodron says over and over. And to do that, you have to be able to go to that place by yourself. John of the Cross says, I go to the place where no one ever is to meet with my beloved. And he called it God, but you could just call it truth or whatever. Your healthiest psychological state, call it whatever you want.
Yeah.
But you have to be able to return and return and return. And I just started doing it to survive. And then I found that when I was there, these bizarrely fortuitous things happened to me. Like I go to the place of peace just to be sane. And then the whole world explodes around me as safe, enticing, and alive and gives me all these things I want. And then people say, tell me how to get the things I want. And I tell them and they're like, okay, but that's too weird. That's way too weird. And I'm willing to like try to stay within their purview, whatever it is, and see if their own yearning can help them take steps forward. Really, it's only suffering that enables us to defy our cultural conditioning.
Well, it's funny because in your masterclass as well, you're talking about how it's through the healing that we strengthen ourselves, you know, and we can help other people to heal until we've been broken in the first place, we don't get to enjoy that experience, if you like.
Yeah, it's interesting. For this book, I just interviewed someone. I interviewed three people that I think are enlightened. And one of them, two of them are women who now, very obscure, one from India, one from America, who now are renowned spiritual teachers. And then one is this man in Brooklyn, New York, who just lives in his apartment. We're all under lockdown. And people come to him from everywhere, from 12-step groups, from therapy groups, from all over. And he's a guy who's been, he was completely shattered by life, you know, growing up poor and Black in New York City, and becoming an alcoholic, becoming a gambling addict, and then healing himself. And now, like, wealthy white people come from around the world to talk to him. And he just sits in his apartment. He says, I get up every day. I say, I work for God, whatever that means. Go ahead, use me. And he told me, your final destination, if you set out on this path of being happy, is service.
Yeah.
You will only want to stick around to help other people out of suffering. And I think that, you know, we've all seen what an exponential growth curve really looks like now. People didn't realize it. I have been studying statistics since I was 17. So I was like, oh yeah, today it's going to be 100 cases of COVID and next week it'll be 10,000. Watch. And then we watched it happen and it's really terrifying. What gives me hope is that I think enlightenment works the same way. I think we may be at the tipping point. Certainly the people I talk to who I think are enlightened say this. They say they can feel the potential for enlightenment brimming in this billions strong human population. And that once it goes, wham, COVID turned our lives around within a few weeks.
Yeah.
And something positive could do the same kind of magic if it exists. I don't know. I'm very happy saying I don't know, but hey, why not play with it? Let's just play with the idea. It's better than killing ourselves.
I mean, one thing I'm noticing is we are having this kind of this revolution in social justice, perhaps. Well, I mean, I use revolution probably a bit too ambitiously, but we're seeing people without a voice speaking up for themselves.
Thank God.
But at the same time, we're seeing a backlash from the other side, the people who are happy with the status quo, you know, trying to denounce this activity that we're seeing. So on the one hand, I am hopeful that there is, you know, this energy for good coming out of it. But on the other hand, there's kind of like this resistance coming from the other side. And I wonder if it's almost like, you know, an unstoppable force meeting a, you know, or what is it, an irresistible force meeting an immovable object.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a dual, we live in a dual reality. Everything is defined by dualistic wave functions and things. There's always a dark for every light. There's a down for every up. And certainly in the United States, we've seen that. And I know in England politically as well, the pendulum is swinging pretty dramatically. I am, you know, the systematic racism in the US has been here since before it was a republic. I mean, it's so deep in the economy and the psychology. And I'm so glad it's being uprooted. And I want my own racism to be uprooted. I'm thrilled. And I would be afraid that the backlash would just continue to swing in an endless pendulum, except for one thing. If you look at the ultimate experience of dualism for us, we say life and death, but life and death, that's not the binary code. It's birth and death. The opposite, Eckhart Tolle says this, the opposite of death is birth. Life has no opposite. And so when people go into an enlightenment experience, or they awaken, or whatever they call it in their culture, they come out of the dualism and they are not in the physical aspect of themselves that was born and will die, even though that doesn't even exist. Every atom in our bodies turns over at least every 7 years. So the body that you were 7 years ago had not one atom in common with the body that's sitting there right now. So what are we? We are wisps. We are concatenations of atoms that cohere in predictable ways around these wisps of consciousness. It's bizarre. And it comes in and it becomes material and it does things. It grows, it matures, it ages, it dies. But what is it that's doing that? Life is what's doing it, and life has no opposite. So ultimately, if the pendulum swings hectically enough, maybe there will be a complete immolation of the dualistic system, and we will sort of come out into a space that is life. And life is equated in all these mystical cultures with love, compassion, nurture, empathy with all beings. Like there are these qualities that could create a sort of a paradisiacal situation, which is what Dante, that's what happened to Dante, I'm sure of it. I mean, read those three books and he's saying, we're in hell now. Here's what it looks like to struggle out of hell. And when you get out of hell, here's who you are. You have no sense of self. You have no sense of control. All moments are one. Everything is possible and everything is love. Over and over and over and over and over, we hear this message from the wisest people on the planet. And over and over and over, we say, nice story. How'd you make that up? It's not true. You know?
I mean, is there a sense then that the whole of humanity is just waiting to be born? We're going through this process and we're just waiting, you know, to find our oneness, whether that comes as some sort of civilization or species ending event that, you know, destroys us all. And then from that, we're reborn into some sort of infinite energy of life, the universe and everything.
It's kind of what Pema Chodron said again, we have to be willing to be annihilated. And that could, I think it wants to happen one way or another. Another shaman once told me, these people are so articulate. He told me, compassion is the evolution of consciousness and the healing of trauma. And he said, consciousness wants to evolve new experiences of compassion because experiences of compassion are valuable in themselves. It's like Emerson said, beauty is its own excuse for being. Yeah. The experience of compassion, joy, and love, those are all their own excuse for being. And consciousness is constantly trying to evolve, at least in his cosmology, consciousness is trying to evolve the capacity to do this in greater numbers. And it can happen within us as we're alive, or it could kill us and in the process of dying, take us there. He didn't care. He said, I don't care one way or the other, which way it comes to me, but I know that's what I'm after. And I know that's what I'm trying to help people experience. And all these holy people from all these different cultures, that was their unanimous voice. And they weren't talking to each other. And they were all saying the same thing. You come out of suffering into a place of peace that was unimaginable when you identified merely as a physical body. You may die. Most people just die. It's not a big deal. If you stay, your only purpose then is to help other people come out of their suffering into this place of unbelievable beauty is its own excuse for being. And that's where we're meant to get. And I do think there's a yearning for it. As much as we debase it and attack it in our culture, I think secretly a lot of people are yearning for that.
Do you think it's because we have these kind of fixed ideas of what success is? And then you have these very so-called successful people who make a lot of money, and then they get sort of 20 years into their career and realize they're deeply dissatisfied and unhappy.
It's not even 20 years. I mean, I have coached a lot of multimillionaires and several billionaires, and not one of them was happy. They were restless and desperate and ravenous. And it just, the more they took in, the more they wanted. I've seen a few say, okay, enough, that's not it, and walk away. But the pressure to keep going with the culture, the momentum of the culture is enormous. But I can tell you, there wasn't a moment's happiness on that path to success for a lot of those people. I've never met someone who achieved great fame and wealth who seemed calm. Of course, they were hiring a life coach, so self-select example. But I think it's independent. I think there are people of great wealth who can, like the Buddha, who can wake up. And I think there are people whose poverty and suffering takes them there. Something is trying to take us all there. I do believe that. Something is always trying to take us there. And the moment you open up to it, like you did on the train, I need courage. And something says, courage!
Yeah.
And that happens enough and you go, oh, this is really just a puppet show, right? I mean, Shakespeare, if you read the, if you take King Lear and the Tempest, it's the same story without enlightenment and forgiveness, and with enlightenment and forgiveness. And Prospero becomes magical in forgiving his total debasement and the loss of his fame and fortune. He gets past it, and it makes him this magical figure who, at the end of Shakespeare's last play, gives this speech that is straight out of the Enlightenment annals from ancient China. We are such stuff as dreams are made on. And then he throws away his magic because even that isn't necessary. And he's in a world that he has helped create that is all about bringing people together in love. That's what the Tempest was for. This whole huge storm was to bring love. And I think he had an Enlightenment experience. Excuse me. I was told at Harvard as a freshman that when Shakespeare wrote that, it was because he was in dementia. That, you know, by the age of 52, he just developed such severe Alzheimer's that he had to write The Tempest.
Well, that's really interesting, actually, because that brings me on to, you talk about Anne Lamott in your book and something she said about children with Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. And your son Adam has Down syndrome. But it resonated with me because it may not just be children with Down syndrome who have this connection to, well, you say they're spies for God. Anne Lamott says they're spies for God. But watching my own daughter, when she was going through that period of starting to verbalize, it made me think that maybe she, and I couldn't understand a word she was saying, but she was desperate to communicate. And it was coming out as this babbling kind of nonsense, if you like. But it meant something to her. And I wonder if when a new spirit comes into our world from the other side of the ethereal plane and they push through the membrane, do they have some message to tell us? And they're so desperate to tell us before they forget and they get limited by the confines of language. And then by the time they learn to speak, maybe they've forgotten about it, you know.
And language is the carrier of culture, remember. It's what, so by the time you've absorbed enough language to communicate, you've absorbed the cultural bias as well. But I've seen, not only do I think you're right, I actually think, and this is part of my strange millennial insanity, I don't mind, I'm very happy to be insane, but I seem to notice that there are children doing things that are, like, a little boy came into my house, a little six-year-old boy before the lockdown, came into my house one day. I knew his mother vaguely. She came, he was there. He walked in the front door and said, "Why do you have two pianos?" And I said, "Oh, because there's one in the living room and there's a little one that my daughter learned on in her bedroom." And then I said, "How do you know we have two pianos?" And he was like, "Well, I can feel them."
Yeah.
And there were two little boys who were playing in my house, and someone started talking. We were talking in one room about Handel and whether Handel was inspired to write the Messiah. And in the other room, a six-year-old and a four-year-old burst spontaneously into the Hallelujah chorus.
Yeah.
They couldn't hear us talking. Not just those things, but constant, any interaction with children I have these days, I feel like they're more into it. Maybe that's what people enlightened are saying is brewing just below the surface. Like, in children, it's so close. By the way, in the novel that I was going to write, the plague was actually a plague of awakening. And so people would lose their cultural bearings, and the carriers were babies because they were completely, they were infected with enlightenment before they could talk. And so anyone who was infected before they could talk was automatically an enlightened being. So, hey, since the plague part is happening, maybe the genius baby thing will happen.
Well, maybe. I mean, well, maybe it's not coming from babies. Maybe it is just a time for people to wake up and realize, you know, they're not happy with the way things are right now.
Let me ask you something, Chris.
Yeah.
Like, gloves off. Have you always had, back at the back of your mind, a sense that something would happen in your lifetime that was really important?
To me or to the world?
The world.
I've always been aware of those stories that your parents tell. You know, when they say, "I remember where I was when JFK was shot," or "I remember where I was when you know, they walked on the moon and this kind of thing. And there, I've seen lots of things, but none of them really stand out to me as the thing. The one thing that I will be able to say to people, I remember where I was when, you know, I've seen people, celebrities die. I've seen Nelson Mandela come out of prison, but nothing world changing. And I'm still waiting for that thing. I do get a sense.
The people who like that particular book, I wrote Finding Your Way in a Wild New World, to the people who felt, who were waiting for it. And I don't know what it is. At the end of the book, I say, I have no idea what we're doing, but we move at dawn. That's what we're all going to do. We're going to do it. What is it? I don't know. And some people feel it more strongly than others.
Yeah.
And there's a beautiful Sioux Indian legend where there's a mouse who is desperate to hear the source of this rushing sound, which is the great river, which is spirit. And he meets a raccoon who tells him, for some mice never hear that sound. And for some, they hear it and they ignore it. And for some, it is so loud, it is like a screaming in their ears. And little brother, you are one of these. And I think some of us are born with the screaming in our ears that would have marked us as medicine people if we'd been born in that tribe. And my experience of people who keep reading that book, who don't just say this is a piece of crap and throw it out, is that they're the ones who are like, wait, when is it? Why hasn't it? What is it? I don't know. And I used to walk around thinking, what is it? What is it? And I would hear in my head this bit of T.S. Eliot's East Coker. And it goes, I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope. And wait without love, for it would be love of the wrong thing. And wait without hope, for it would be hope of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the love and the hope and the faith are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not ready for thought. So the darkness shall be the light and the stillness the dancing. And that was my answer to what am I waiting for?
Yeah.
We're not ready for thought. I think we're almost ready for thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes me think, you know, they talk about many religions talk about the real name of God can't be spoken. Yeah. And that makes me think again of Lao Tzu and the Tao Te Ching, you know, those who know don't speak, or, you know, and then again, it's that complete and ultimate surrender that Pema Chodron talks about. We have to let go of what we know, let go of what we think we were hoping for and waiting for, and just completely release ourselves into wordlessness and into oneness, maybe.
Yeah, and I think there are so many ways that we have of doing that, and they're very, very simple. So I'd really encourage all your listeners to do things like just try breathing exercises. There are ways you can change your neurology, you can change your physiology. If you can do that just a few minutes a day, there's a tremendous opportunity in the time we're seeing now. When people in Asia wanted to seek enlightenment, which they did much more than in the West, but also the Christian mystics and the Sufis and all that, they would do two things. They would go off by themselves alone, and they would restrict their movements. And that's what's happening to us. We're being isolated, and we're being left in a place where we can't go anywhere. We can't do anything externally. And that kind of drives inquiry down into the depth of self instead of outward into the world around us. So we're being forced to do the two things that cause enlightenment: isolate ourselves and not have anything to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's when you wake up. So just relaxing into what's happening now, which is God awful, and saying, I can't control it. I don't know what it is. Okay. I'm going to surrender all resistance to this happening. I really think that's enough to wake us up.
Do you think that, you know, we become tuned into these kind of messages from both our subconscious and from the everywhere, or, you know, this wider force of life that lives out there? Do you think maybe it's saying, enough with the subtlety now, I'm going to send you a massive message and, you know, pay attention?
Yeah, I do. And I don't know what the upcoming years are going to bring, but I do know that exponential change is happening, and the exponent of the exponential change is growing exponentially. Yeah. So what happened this last strange 6 months could double in the next 6 months. It could get doubly strange, and then in the next 6 months, it quadruples. So if we can relax into what's happening to us, and it's like the time in the ayahuasca ceremony where the trees picked me up and shook me for an hour and a half, the whole world is doing that. The viral kingdom is trying to help us. But we have to relax into it and allow it and let ourselves be taken.
So I know we are coming closely towards the end of our time, so I won't keep you too much longer. But in terms of that, that's kind of talking about global spirituality, if you like, and the kind of a new order, maybe, or at least a new way of being on a global level. But in your coaching, you deal with people on a personal level. And yeah. You've said that when we align with our kind of true selves, if you like, this intrinsic sense of self, we start to really live life, and life kind of shows up for us, and we start to be much happier in every sense, you know, spiritually, personally, physically, mentally, and even making more money, if you like. So what is that one step that people can do to start off on that road to finding their true intrinsic self?
The going by yourself and sitting quietly. Pascal said that the majority of our misery comes from the fact that we can't sit quietly alone in a room.
Yeah.
Go sit quietly alone in a room. And then here's the thing. We talked about how our hopes have been crushed by society so many times. Let yourself hope again. Let yourself hope that what you yearn for could be possible. British literature is the greatest body of literature on earth for taking the dreams of young people and making them seem real and possible. And I would include Shakespeare in that, by the way, it's not children, but this ability to look at the wonder of the world and keep it safe in the context of a very rigid social system, there's a treasure there. And if you can do in your own heart what you do when you read to your four-year-old from Winnie the Pooh or Peter Pan or whatever it is, if you can allow yourself that yearning and not slap it down in yourself, yeah, it will start to come true. It will start to happen. And then you'll have to be very careful about how you talk to people, because you may get pilloried or you may write a book and, and you don't know which way it's going to go then.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Fantastic. So I could carry on talking for hours and hours and hours. There's so much. Like I said, your writing really resonates with me, because I am I do have a kind of rational belief in miracles.
Me too.
Just when, you know, I step outside and I've had a hard day. I have a day job as well, and I've had a hard day on my day job. And I go and I see the way the trees are moving when the wind blows through them. And there's that knowledge that there's something more wholesome that we can connect to, that is more about where we come from, I think is really powerful. But I'm so grateful for your time. Thank you so much for this. Oh, I really appreciate
it. Thank you so much for talking to me. I could talk to you all day as well. So I hope we meet again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So there we go. That was the amazing Martha Beck. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. If you're watching this on YouTube, you will have seen that I have a little bit less hair back then. I had my first pandemic haircut and was keeping it pretty short, as you'll no doubt. You might have confused me a little bit with Jason Statham, perhaps, or The Rock. But don't worry, it was me. I'm a little bit older and wiser now and a bit more hirsute. Anyway, normal service will be resumed next week. So check us out wherever you get your podcasts. Head over to conversationsonliving.com and you can find out more about my books, my writing. Sign up to our monthly newsletter there as well. I hope you enjoyed that, and thank you for listening and making it this far. I get so much wisdom and inspiration from these conversations, and I hope you do too. So until next week, I will see you soon. Cheers.